For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
It is July the 1st in Shmuel Beis. We are up to Perek Chav, chapter 20. So the last thing we had was that we had the threat that this rebellion would continue, and David needed to consolidate his retaking of the throne, and he chose to emphasize the people of Yehuda over the rest of the Jewish people, deciding that was the more that was the more important group to make sure he had their support, since this really was an internal rebellion within Yehuda itself. So he felt he had to, and the way he did that was, first of all, he had the people of Yehuda lead him back to Yerushalayim, even though that made the rest of the Jewish people feel they were left out. Nevertheless, he felt that was important to do. Plus, he promoted the general of Avshalom, who is Amasa ben Yeser. He promoted him to be the new general in place of Yoav. That was the other thing he did. So that drama, as we said, is going to play out tonight. The Amasa and Yoav story is going to be concluded tonight. But the first thing that happens is we actually have someone who wants to continue the rebellion. Bisham Nikra Ish Belial. And then there was called a man who was Belial. Belial means who has thrown off the yoke of heaven. Ushmo Sheva ben Bichri. His name was Sheva ben Bichri. When you have a girl whose name is Bas Sheva, and you shorten her name to Sheva, it's really a boy's name. Okay, Sheva ben Bichri, Ish Yemini, and he was Ish Yemini, which always means a person from Binyamin. So he was from the tribe of Binyamin. Now that always, whenever you see in regard to David, a man from Binyamin, you always have to consider Shaul's family, right? Vayiska ba'shofar, he blew on the shofar, vayomer, he said, Ein lanu chelek b'David, we do not have any portion with David, v'lo nachal alanu b'ven Yishai, we have no inheritance to us, along with the son of Yishai, meaning David, ish la'ohalav Yisrael, each man of the Jews should go to their own tent. In other words, we're not interested in David retaking the throne, we don't care about David. Vayal kol ish Yisrael me'acharei David, so all the men of Yisrael, not Yehuda, the men of Yisrael, left David, Acharei Sheva ben Michri, and they follow Sheva ben Michri. V'yish Yehuda, but the men of Yehuda, Davku b'Malkam, they clung to their king, min ha'yardein v'ad Yerushalayim, from the Yarden all the way till Yerushalayim, they stayed with David. Now when it says all the men of Yisrael followed Sheva ben Michri, it doesn't mean all, it means many. It means there's a multitude of people that followed him. So Sheva ben Michri managed to gather to himself a lot of the disgruntled people who were behind Avshalom, now move in behind Sheva ben Bichri. And as we've mentioned before, rebellions tend to do this, because once you open the floodgates, you know, any government system, no matter what it's going to be, is going to have disgruntled people. You can't satisfy everybody. And normally there is the abhorrence of a rebellion because you have a popular leader, and it's considered to be something which is just not done. But once you have a rebellion, you end up with rebellion after rebellion, and all rebellions do this. The Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, you end up with, you can just see in history, you just see once you open the floodgates of rebellion, then the whole place becomes very, very unsettled for a while. Now, here there's an advantage in that the original king is coming back, which is David. Nevertheless, Sheva ben Michri has managed to, he must have been a charismatic person, and he's managed to gather some of those who were disgruntled, especially from the people of Yisrael, who were already put off by the fact that they were made second fiddle to the people of Yehuda who led David back to Yerushalayim. Pasuk Gimel, verse 3. Vayavo David al beiso Yerushalayim. David came to his house to Yerushalayim. Vayikach hamelech eser nashim pilagshim. And the king took the 10 concubines. I told you we were going to get back to them.
They were given, violated by
us. Yes, yes. Asher hiniach lishmor habayis, that he had left to guard the house, which, remember, he had left them there because he had assumed that nothing would happen to them. Because what could, they're just concubines, they're nothing, they're not dangerous, and there's no way Avshalom would do anything to them. But of course he was wrong. Avshalom did. He molested them. Vayit neim beis mishmeres vayichalkeim, and he put them in a house that was protected, which means that no one could bother them, and he supported them, meaning he gave them all their needs, their food and their clothing, whatever they needed. Va'alehem lova, but he was not intimate with them. Va'tiyena tsururos adyom musan, and they were bound up until the day of their deaths. Almanus chayus, widows alive, means living widows, which means their husband is alive, and yet they are still considered widows because they can't be with their husband and they can't be with anybody else.
Here, what about their children?
What about the children?
Do they have any children, these concubines?
They may have. The children are fine. They're regular.
They see the children?
Yeah. They weren't in prison. Okay. They were protected. And David HaMelech was affording them protection the same way that a husband provides the needs for his wife, provides food and shelter and protection, all that.
David didn't go see them anymore.
Well, you'll see, he did see them, but he wasn't intimate with them. He put them, but he gave them all of their needs. He set them up properly, but he did not. He was not intimate with them. Now, this pasuk, before we talk about what he actually did, the pasuk seems to be a non sequitur, because the real issue here is Sheva ben Bichri, that he started this new rebellion. The next pasuk is going to be that David is going to take steps to put down this new rebellion with Amasa, and then we're going to have the drama with Amasa and Yoav, and then the drama with Yoav and Sheva ben Bichri. We're going to have a whole bunch of things going on. This is a standalone pasuk which just gets stuck in here in the middle. Now, it has to be said somewhere, and I guess chronologically it makes sense, because here David comes to the palace and this is what he does. But the Navi could have told this to us after the whole story was over. After the story of Sheva ben Bichri is over, the Navi could have told this to us. So it's important to note that the Navi inserts it in the middle of a story, and that's not insignificant. Now, what exactly is the story over here? Why is David doing this, and what is going on over here? So we have here a serious issue, which is that the rule is that no one is allowed, no non-king, at least, maybe even another king, but at least non-kings are not allowed to use or be involved with that which was the domain of a king. So when a king dies, non-kings cannot use his furniture, they can't use his possessions, and they also can't marry his wives. His wives have become widows. When he dies, a non-king cannot marry those widows. There is a discussion whether a king can marry the widows of another king, and the proof that they can is from David, because he was given the widows of Sheol. Hashem says to David, I'll give you the wives of your master. So one king could marry the widows of a previous king, but a non-king cannot. Avshalom was not a king. And Avshalom lived with these concubines. So now, they didn't do it willingly. You know the rule is that if a married woman commits adultery willingly, so even if there's no warning to put her to death, because it's a death penalty for it, so even if there's no warning to put her, because nobody warned her, so she can't be put to death, nevertheless she becomes prohibited to her husband if she willingly committed adultery. If she was molested, God forbid, so then if her husband is not a Kohen, she is permitted to her husband. If her husband is a Kohen, she becomes prohibited to her husband. That's the rule of a married woman who has an intimate relationship with somebody else, whether it is consensual or if it is against her will. Now, here, this was not consensual. So if they had been married to a regular Jew, not a Kohen, but a regular non-king, they would be permitted to their husband. But the thing is, over here, in addition to the fact that it was a problem of adultery, it's also the problem that somebody who was not a king now was intimate with the wives of a king. And there is a big discussion in the Gemara whether that prohibits the wives to the husband. So there's two opinions over here. One opinion is that they actually became prohibited. Halachically, they were now prohibited to David. Now that Avshalom had molested them, that made them prohibited to David. So what does David do? He says, look, I can't, it's not their fault. Right? So David takes care of them and he sets them up. But unfortunately, they are now stuck because they can't live with David, but they also can't live with anybody else because they were the Pilagshim of a king, which means they're prohibited to everybody else also. So they get stuck in a halachic status of almanus chayus, of living widows, where they can't be with their husband, but they can't be with anybody else either. So David does the best he can for them, which he sets them up, and they're taken care of. All their needs are taken care of, but they are unable to be intimate with anybody. That's one opinion in the Gemara. The other opinion of the Gemara is that they certainly couldn't go to anybody else, because they were David's wives, but they were still technically permitted to David. They were technically permitted. However, David was not intimate with them, even though they were technically permitted. Now, why would he not be intimate with them? So the main reason seems to be, it's not so clear, the main reason seems to be because David was the they were making a statement that Avshalom was not a king. Mm-hmm. You see, if Avshalom was a king, then they would for sure be permitted to David. There would be no debate about it. The fact that Avshalom was not a king is what makes their status questionable. So by not living with them, what is the statement that's being made is, Avshalom, he's a nobody. He wasn't king. So it's another, just like Avshalom was using them in a way to show that he was king, it's being turned around to show that he wasn't king. But that is only one aspect of it. But the Gemara says what David did is he gave them everything they needed, and they had nice clothing, they had perfumes, they had makeup, they had everything to be beautiful. And what David did is he made sure to see them, and then he spoke to his Yetzer Hara, and he said to his Yetzer Hara, you took something that was prohibited to you, now you're not going to take something that's permitted to you. And so what David did is he broke his Yetzer Hara. He said to himself, my Yetzer Hara got the better of me last time, even though, as we explained last time, it was a very subtle Yetzer Hara. Nevertheless, it was a Yetzer Hara. And what David did is he broke his Yetzer Hara by presenting something permitted and not allowing himself to act upon it. And in that way, he broke his taiva, he broke his inclination.
Yep. So this is tshuva?
It's a form of tshuva, right? That's right, it's a form of tshuva. Now, you can't do that. A person is not allowed to put themselves, and we've talked, I mean, that was the whole problem, was that David asked for a nisan. He asked to be tested, and that was a problem. You're not allowed to put yourself in a situation of temptation. You're not allowed to do that. I told you before, the Gemara says if a man needs to travel somewhere, and there are two ways to go. And one way to go, there are women who are not dressed properly. The other way to go, everything is fine. And he goes on the path where he knows the women are not dressed properly, and he closes his eyes so he doesn't look at them. The Gemara says, Nikra Rasha. He's called an evil person. He's evil. Why is he evil? He didn't look. But he's evil because he deliberately put himself in a position of temptation. You're not allowed to do that. It's prohibited to do that. Hashem puts us in positions of temptation. That's up to Hashem. He calibrates when we need to be tested and when not. But we're not allowed to do that. Here, David would only be able to do this if they were in fact permitted. Because then it's not temptation to do an Avera. He's breaking his inclination, but he's not putting himself in an area of temptation in a situation where it's actually prohibited. So if they were actually prohibited to him, he would have stayed away from them completely, because he's not allowed to put himself in an area in a situation of temptation. But because according to this opinion they were permitted, so he was able to do that. So That is what is happening here with these 10 Pilagshim. Now, what this also does in the broader sense is, from the Pilagshim's point of view, think about them for a moment. Here you have women who are not full wives. Now, they are the Pilagshim of the king, which is pretty special, but they're still not full wives. Now, why weren't they full wives? What exactly, why would a woman be a Pilagish and not be a full-fledged wife? It's not her choice.
She's already got 18 wives, or whatever. And she can't
have more. Okay, that could be, it could be. But clearly, they were a lower status. Now, they were molested publicly. It must have been extremely embarrassing for these women, for what happened with Avshalom. You know, that they pitched the tents on the roof, they had no choice, they were forced, and it must have been, it's not just the actual act of molestation, which is clearly a terrible thing, but then it's done publicly. That was the whole, we talked about how terrible what Avshalom did is, that he did an act like this in a public fashion, throwing away tznius, throwing away any form of modesty, and these women were put through that. It must have been just horrific for a woman who's at tzanua, mm-hmm, to have to go through that. It's got to be horrible. So here, these women are now being part of correcting a problem that the king David went through. So here you have David, who's of the greatest people who ever lived, who made a mistake, and now he needs to correct the problem. Obviously, he's going to explain to them what he's doing. He's not going to do this. I mean, it doesn't make any sense without explaining to them. So here, you're taking these women who were degraded, who were physically degraded in front of, you know, publicly. It was on TV. I mean, it's people physically degraded, and he's empowering them and telling them, you're going to be a part of this endeavor of breaking my Yetzirah, which was my mistake, and I'm the king, which means I represent all the Jewish people, and you're going to make David HaMelech a greater David HaMelech. I don't want to get so specific over here, and I'm a man, so I'm not going to pretend to be fully cognizant of this whole thing, but I imagine that when something like that happens to a woman, her whole relationship with what it means to be beautiful, what does it mean to be attractive, must be called into question. The whole thing becomes it's got to shatter a woman's ability to think about herself properly. So here, what he's doing is telling them, dress up, be beautiful, and I'm going to break my Yetzirah. So they're going to use their beauty, which they must have had, because otherwise, what's the temptation, right? So they're going to use their beauty in a way that's going to build the king.
That's very nice.
To a greater place. So from that perspective, even though it means they can't be with a man, they can't be with their husband, I don't know what it meant anyway. A Pilagish, if there are 10 Pilagshim and there's more wives, how often would they have been with him anyway? I mean, we're not talking about a regular thing anyway. So I don't know what ends up being taken away over here.
Next night.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know.
For sure, right? Because he's obligated on mikvah night to be with them if he's not at war.
Yeah, if he's not at war, if he's not out, you know, running the country, like, it depends if he's around.
Same cycle.
Yeah, it doesn't work that way. But the king, he's so caught up by everything else. Plus, at this point in time, David is towards the end of his life. He's not a young man anymore. So I just don't know.
But that can't be, because we went through the whole thing with the 12 tissues or whatever before. So you can't use that now if he's
No, I know that. I know he's capable. What I mean to say is that David is at a place in life where he's extremely busy with the country, and I'm not sure exactly what they're giving up over here, but what they're being given is the ability to use their physical appearance, attractiveness, in a way that is, there's no other way to put it, is to be Mekadesh Shem Shemayim. It's to sanctify God's name. So for a woman who her own attractiveness was turned against her in such a terrible way, to be able to use it in a positive way, and in an extremely positive way, I imagine that that's very comforting.
But most of the time, and in this case also, the reason they were molested had nothing to do with their beauty. It had to do with their status and power and control.
Yes.
So that's what it had to do with. And nowadays, I don't know what it was like then, but nowadays when women are molested, they feel unworthy of being loved, and so the best kindness to them is to show them love.
Okay.
Which is against what he's doing, because he's just doing the opposite.
Okay.
But it might have been different back then.
It might have been different.
Times were different.
Relationships were different also.
Right. Everything was different.
Yeah, it was a whole different...
But it's hard to...
It's interesting. Interesting today, that may not work today. You're right. It may be different. Right. Now, why is this mentioned here? It could have been mentioned anywhere. So I'm going to show you when we get to Malachim, that from here on in, whenever there is a threat to the kingdom, David will do something which will show his absolute scrupulousness with this area, with how to deal with women. We're going to see that he's extremely careful. It happens here. It's going to happen in the beginning of Malachim when Adoniyahu is trying to rebel against Shlomo while David is still alive. And over there, it's going to be involving Avishag HaShunamis, where the Navi is going to tell us explicitly David was not intimate with her. And the reason why the Navi is doing this is to tell us that if you want to know what zechus does David have for the kingdom to be reconsolidated over here, and later on for the kingdom to go smoothly from him to Shlomo, it's going to be the fact that he learned from his mistake with Bathsheba, and now he is absolutely, completely careful in this area, much more than before. And that's the main zchus, that's the main merit that David has. The Gemara tells us that we learn teshuvah from David. David teaches us teshuvah. Because David didn't just feel bad, he didn't just beg forgiveness, he actually was proactive in turning around the problem and becoming the example of the one who was very careful. And so here, it's the reason why the Navi puts it in over here is to explain to us that when we're going to see that this rebellion of Sheva ben Bichri is going to be put down very quickly and almost what's going to appear effortlessly, that is because of the schus, the merit of David, in that he was breaking his Yetzer Hara.
All right, but once you brought up Avishag, I have other questions.
Yeah, but...
Is a king allowed to have?
I don't know. I don't know the answer.
Okay. And even after David's death, I mean, there's people who would like to take Avishag just to prove
same person, Adoniel.
So he didn't learn his lesson because he didn't protect these Pelagshim, and he's not protecting
Avishag
later on.
No, Avishag's protected.
After his death.
No, Avishag's protected. No one wants to take her forcibly. No, she's protected.
She's protected?
Yeah. There's nothing... Adoniel tries to get her hand in marriage. He sends Bathsheba to ask Shlomo for her permission to marry her.
Uh-huh.
She's not attacked. Yeah. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech haolam
shehakol nehyeh
bidvaro.
Amen. Oh, I think another aspect that makes it relevant here is that these are the only people that David has to deal with in terms of cleaning up the rebellion in his own household. He gets back to his own home, and he's got this leftover problem from Avshalom, and he has to resolve it in a way that's fair to them and that shows he's reestablishing himself as king. So there are also political overtones that make it suitable for this, you know, he comes back and all the men around him can profess their loyalty to him, but he's still faced with the fallout, you know,
right,
of this rebellion.
Right. So that's a good point. So these 10 Pelagshim certainly are a fallout. That is true.
The only other thing I wanted to say is that your description of David's carefulness in this area is reminiscent of Yosef being called Yosef Hatzadik.
That's right. It's the same idea. Same idea that over there. He becomes the example of the one who is careful. Right. Exactly. The same exact thing.
And not just that. You see that he wants to increase his Yetzer Tov, his connection to Hashem Baruch Hu, to grow closer to Hashem Baruch Hu, like Moshe Rabbeinu. Like Moshe separated from Zipporah, but at that point he was in the level of Kedusha in the service of Hashem Baruch Hu, and David now wants to do this.
Okay, it's not exact. Moshe was told he had to separate, and David does not separate from his other wives.
Oh, okay.
So it's not really a parallel to that. Okay. But certainly in this way, yes.
If I could just say one more thing. Yeah. The way this works as Teshuvah is if one admits the possibility that they were permitted to him. Had they been prohibited, it would not
That's
have
right.
been effective to Teshuvah.
Right.
He would not have had a desire for them, I'm sure, on his level.
Well, he wouldn't have been allowed to put himself in that position.
Right.
So he
right.
wouldn't have
But the way this whole thing works is if there is a doubt that they might be
right. Just as with Bathsheba, it was somewhat
right.
doubtful.
Right.
Like, right, exactly. It was very, very, the whole thing was complicated.
Now, of these 10 women, worse than none of them had children from the molestation.
It doesn't say that they did, and I assume they did not. Plus halachically, we would not attribute the child to Avshalom. If it was only one time, provided that they had been with David at some point in the recent past, we would not have attributed them halachically to Avshalom. There's no DNA testing. So there's a halachic presumption. Even if a woman, God forbid, commits adultery, and there's a pregnancy, if she's regularly with her husband, we presume that the child is from the husband. So it would only be if the woman was estranged from her husband for a significant period of time, and then there's a pregnancy. Right. Okay. Dalet, verse 4. Vayom HaMelech al Amasa, so the king says to Amasa, who is the new general, Hazek Lias Ish Yehuda, gather for me the men of Yehuda shloshes yamim, 3 days. Take 3 days and gather them. Ve'ata po'amod, and then you be here, stand here. In other words, I want you back here in 3 days. David was concerned that if it took more than 3 days, then Sheva ben Bichri would grow stronger in power. And David feels that we have to quell this rebellion now. So he gives them 3 days to gather the soldiers of Yehuda. So Hamasa went to gather the people of Yehuda. And he was late in the time that David had set for him. Now, this is not a very auspicious start in being the new general. The first command that David gives him, and Hamasa is tardy. He doesn't show up on time. He doesn't gather them in time. Now, there's a reason for it, but we'll get to the reason in a moment. Vayomer David el Avishai. So now what's David going to do? He wants he wants Sheva ben Bichri to be pursued. So he turns now to Avishai. He's not going to turn to Yoav, who is the deposed general. He turns to Avishai, who is Yoav's brother, and also a great warrior, as we've seen before. And he says to Avishai, Ata yere lanu Sheva ben Bichri min Avshalom. Now Sheva ben Bichri will be worse for us than Avshalom. We're going to be in a worse place. Ata kaches avde adonecha, you take the servants of your master, meaning my servants, uredof acharav, and chase after him. In other words, take whoever is here in Yerushalayim and chase after Sheva ben Bichri, pen matzalo arim bitzuros, lest he find for himself fortified cities, vihitzil einenu, and he will be saved from our eyes. So go, take whatever we got, and run after him.
Could I ask you a question before?
Yeah, I just, I'm getting,
right, go
okay. Vayetsu acharav anshe Yoav, and the men of Yoav went out after him. Now it's the men of Yoav they're called, because Yoav has been the general until now, and this is the palace guard, and they're the men of Yoav. So the men of Yoav go out after him. V'hakresi, v'haplesi, v'chol ha-giborim, and the kresi and the plesi, this is translated as the archers and the catapult
slingers,
right? The slingers, okay, and all of the strong ones. Vayetsu miYerushalayim, and they went out of Yerushalayim liirdof acharei Sheva ben Bichri, to chase after Sheva ben Bichri. Now this is a bold and also dangerous move because you're leaving the city unguarded. Now, that's not going to be a problem. Nothing's going to happen. But this is not what you would say is your first choice. You don't want to take the palace guard and send them off on some sort of a chase throughout Eretz Yisrael because you leave the palace unguarded. But David had no choice because Amasa was late in getting back to Yerushalayim. Haim im ha'evan ha'gedola shebegivon. They were with the great stone that was at Givon, which was a landmark. Va'amasa ba'lifneim, and Amasa came before them. So Amasa finally shows up, and Amasa has with him the soldiers of Yehuda. So now they're going to join forces and chase after Sheva ben Michri. Now Yoav was there because Yoav is part of the palace guard. For Yoav chagor mido levusho, and Yoav was girded. With his army cloak, whatever it was, he was girded for war, which you'd expect. I mean, they're going to fight. Ve'alav chagor cherev, and on him was attached to him a sword, which is also expected. However, what's unusual is mitzumedes al masnav bisara, which was against his midsection in its sheath. Now, what that means is that normally a sword is worn with the sheath pointed down, mm-hmm. and the sword goes in, and when you want to pull the sword out, you pull it out, right? Now, if you have to pull out your sword, it's a two-step motion. You pull it out, and then you have to attack. So it takes a little bit of time. Yoav was wearing his sword a little differently. He was wearing it horizontally, so that it jutted out. It was. I'm not sure if it jutted out this way or if it was against his stomach this way, but it was horizontal. It was perpendicular to his body, mm-hmm. rather than along his leg, which made it a lot easier to quickly pull it out and use it. It's a lot quicker. The problem is, so if it's quicker, why doesn't everybody wear their sword that way? The problem is that if you wear your sword that way, if you bend over a little bit, the sword falls out of its sheath. So it's not practical to wear the sword that way. So even though it's in terms of battle, it takes more time to pull the sword out when it's lengthwise, when it's going down the leg, but it is not practical to walk around with it sideways because it can fall out easily. But that's exactly what you all have wanted. Yoav wanted it to fall out easily. That's why he wore it this way. Vehu yatsa, and it came out. Vatipol, and it fell down. So the sword fell down. Vayomer Yoav la'amasa. Yoav said to Amasa, Hashalom atachi. Is it peaceful for you, my brother? Vatochez yad yimin Yoav bizkan Amasa lin shaklo. And Yoav grabbed with his right hand, he grabbed the beard of Amasa in order to kiss him. It's a kissing of greeting. Amasa was not careful about the sword that was in the hand of Yoav. Yoav was holding his sword because it had fallen down and he picked it up. And now he's holding his sword and he leans forward to kiss Amasa. Amasa leans forward and Yoav ayakehu va el hachomesh, and he strikes him against the fifth rib. Vayishpoch meyav. Yoav strikes Amasa against the fifth rib. Vayishpoch meyav artsa. This is a little bit graphic, but his insides poured out. Velo shanalo, he didn't have to hit him again. Just one strike. Vayamos, and he died. Vayoav vavishai achiv, and then Yoav and Avishai, his brother, radaf akarei Sheva ben Michri, chased after Sheva ben Michri, so that he killed Amasa. Now he can run off and do the job of taking care of Sheva ben Michri. Now, let's read. Let's read a little further, just a little bit. V'ish amar olav minare Yoav, and a man stood over him from the lads of Yoav, meaning stood over the Amasa. Vayomer, he said, Mi asher chafetz b'Yoav, whoever is interested in Yoav, is happy with Yoav, Umiya Shaladavid, and whoever is for David, Achara Yoav should go after Yoav. So one of Yoav's men now rallies people around Yoav, because Amasa is now dead, so there's a new person who's got to be the general. Is it going to be Avishai or Yoav? So one of Yoav's lads gets up and says, okay, now everybody rally around Yoav. V'amasa misgolel badam b'soch ha-mesila. But Amasa was literally rolling in blood in the path. Fayar ha'ish ki amad kol ha'am. So the man, meaning Yoav's lad, saw that all the people were stopping. So because they were running and they would see Amasa and they would all stop and they wouldn't go after Yoav. Vayaseves Amasa min ha'mesila ha'sadeh. So he moved Amasa's body from the path to the field. Vayashlech alav begin, and he threw upon him a cloak. When he saw everybody was coming and stopping, this way no one would stop, and they would go on to go with Yoav to go get Sheva ben Bichri. Kasher hoga min hamesila, when he was moved from the path, then avar kolish acharei Yoav, all the men passed after Yoav, lirdof acharei Sheva ben Bichri, the chase after Sheva ben Bichri, and that's where we're going to pick up the story next, which is going to be the actual chase of Sheva ben Bichri and the eventual ending of his rebellion. But before we do that, of course, we have to address this confrontation between Yoav and Amasa ben Yeser. Now, there's no question that if we are to read this without any depth and just read it through as if, you know, as the rest of the world just reads it, then we would presume that the reason why Yoav kills Amasa is because he's jealous, because he was just replaced by Amasa, and Yoav is interested in getting him back and getting rid of him. And here was the opportunity that he had. So when Amasa comes back, Yoav kills him. Very straightforward. It is simply an act of revenge. There are several problems with that suggestion. One problem is that we are going to find that at the end of this whole thing with Sheva ben Bichri, the new general is Yoav. Yoav goes right back to his post. Now, if Yoav was simply taking revenge on Amasa, so first of all, he should be executed. Second of all, that was going to put him back to being general. Like, the man's a problem. He has a very capable second, which is Avishai. Plus, we're going to see a new figure on the scene who's going to come up at the end of the Battle of Sheva ben Bichri, a new figure who is the up-and-coming general, who will be the general under Shlomo HaMelech, whose name is Binayahu ben Yehoyada. The Gemara only has excellent things to say about Binayahu ben Yehoyada. Besides all the physical prowess and his great ability in war, but the tzaddik that he is, the Talmud Chacham that he is, all the great, you know, the accolades for Binayahu ben Yehoyada. So he's going to emerge on the scene as well coming up. So it's not like David doesn't have other possibilities. So it's difficult if we're to say that this is simply an act of revenge. The other problem here is, and you have to be aware of this, because the whole thing doesn't make sense with this. The Gemara makes the point that Yoav says to Amasa, "Hey, my friend, how you doing?" And he leans forward to kiss him. He's holding a sword in his hand. And it says Amasa wasn't careful about the sword in the hand of Yoav. It doesn't say Amasa didn't notice the sword in the hand of Yoav. Yoav dropped his sword and picked it up. Amasa saw that, but he wasn't careful. Says the Gemara, why wasn't he careful? What is Amasa, a fool? You have Yoav here, who's out to get him, who's angry about being replaced, and they're embracing, but he's holding a sword in his hand. What are you doing? And Amasa is himself an accomplished warrior. It's not an accomplished warrior doesn't make mistakes like this. Mm-hmm. If someone's approaching you with a sword in hand, you know, right? The Gemara says, you know why Amasa wasn't careful about the sword in Yoav's hand? Because he didn't suspect him. Sure. Amasa presumed that Yoav had nothing but love for him. Amasa did not presume that Yoav was jealous and wanted to get rid of him. Now, I don't know about you. But if I am given a position that someone else just had, and the other person is still here, I think they're going to be a little guarded. I mean, you know, and I don't have experience in war or anything like that, but I'm saying, I would imagine that it doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that you got to be careful with people who were just replaced and who are bitter about it. You don't go hugging them when they're holding a sword in their hand. So we have to understand that Amasa did not presume any malice, and the reason he didn't presume any malice is because, at least consciously, Yoav was not acting with malice. That wasn't where he was coming from. So where was he coming from? The Gemara tells us. The Gemara tells us why Yoav did what he did, and it wasn't because he was replaced. Mm-hmm. That's the unbelievable thing. Yoav recognized that his replacement, even if it wasn't to his liking, it's not Amasa's fault. And Yoav doesn't see this as a problem. Yoav is a loyal servant of David. He's going to go quell this rebellion with Sheva and Bichri. And Yoav, we don't know whether he reacted well or didn't react well to being replaced. But Yoav is bigger than taking it out on the messenger, on the one who replaced him. It wasn't Amasa's. If you have a problem, it's with David. It's not with Amasa. So Yoav is not reacting to that. The Gemara tells us that's not what he was upset about. So then, why did he kill Amasa?
He was late.
Because he was late.
Because
he disobeyed the king. Mm-hmm. Yoav here is displaying the same thing we've seen from Yoav from day one. Mm-hmm. Yoav says, if you rebel against the king, there is only one answer, and that's the tip of my sword. There is no other answer. And I don't care who you are, I don't care why you did it, but if you rebel, you get killed. And that's why he killed Avner, and that's why he killed Avshalom, and that's why he killed Amasa, because he said Amasa was rebellious in that he did not get back here in time. The king gave him a direct order, get back here, and he didn't do it. And therefore, he kills Amasa. Now, it is true, as we've seen, that Yoav himself has had times that he has not done like the king. We've seen that. But in all those situations, they're all situations where Yoav holds that it is better for the king. In other words, it's true he's not listening to David, like when he kills Avshalom. And he wasn't listening to David when he killed Avner. But he held that it is better for the king, that the king is making a mistake over here in not getting rid of the one who is the central point of the rebellion, which is Avshalom. That's why he killed him. So even in the situations where he's disobeying David, but he's not disobeying David because he's trying to promote himself, he's disobeying David because he's trying to promote David. So you can argue whether he's right or wrong, but his motivation is to promote David. That is always Yoav's motivation, to promote David HaMelech. And here, he again is promoting David HaMelech. Now, he's wrong for doing this. Why is he wrong for doing it? If, in fact, Amasa was rebellious, then why is he wrong for doing it?
We don't know why he was late.
So the Gemara tells us why he was late. Now, if there was any other reason but the reason we're going to say, then he was rebellious. He wasn't late because there were storms in Hartsfield and the planes weren't taking off, right? He was late because he was late. So, whatever the reason is, if the king tells you to get back in 3 days, you're back in 3 days. But there's one exception. The reason he was late is because the king told him, gather the soldiers of Yehuda. He went to gather them, and when he found the bulk of the soldiers, they had just sat down to begin a new Masechta, to begin learning a new tractate. They had just sat down the table. And Amasa said, the king told me to bring them. But that means stopping them from their Torah study. Well, am I allowed to do that or not? So the Pasuk says in Sefer Yehoshua that when Yehoshua was appointed as the leader, so it says over there that anyone, Kolisha Shayamra Espicha, anyone who will rebel against your word, this is a Haftarah for Parashas Mizos HaBracha that we say on Simchas Torah. Over there it says, I'll read it to you. Over there it says in Sefer Yehoshua, it's the first chapter of Yehoshua. So over there it says, Kol Isha, it's the last pasuk. Kol Isha sheyamra espicha, any man who will not listen to your words, will go rebel against your words, v'lo yishmas tvarecha, will not listen to your words, v'chol asher titzavenu, for anything you command him, you must, he will die. So here is the pasuk that tells us that if someone is rebellious, it put him to death. It also says in the Torah, but here it's more explicit. Then the last three words are rak, chazak, ve'ematz. Only strengthen yourself and persevere. Chazak ve'ematz. But it says rak, only. The word rak always means an exclusion. It's a term that means to exclude something. In the Torah, it's always used to mean to exclude another. What is it excluding over here? Any man who will rebel against you and doesn't listen to you will be put to death. Only be strong and persevere. What do you mean only? So rak means that if the king says to stop the study of Torah, we don't listen to the king. Rak. We don't listen to the king, not just to stop the study of Torah. If he's going to go against the Torah, we don't listen to the king. Avner also did not listen to Shaul when Shaul said to do what? Remember? To kill out
Nov,
the city of the Kohanim. Avner didn't listen. Was he rebellious? No, because it says Rak, Chazak Ve'ematz. If the king says to do something which goes against the Torah, we don't listen to the king. Now, in the case of Shaul knew what he was saying. Avner didn't listen. Here, David didn't know that the men were starting the new learning, but once Amasa got there and he realized it, so he did not interrupt them because it says Rak Chazak Ve'ematz only, which means to exclude those who have begun the study of Torah, to exclude a case where it goes against the Torah. So therefore he was late because he waited till they were done. They were studying for several hours. When they broke for lunch or for dinner or whatever it was, then he told them, okay, we're out of here. We gotta go to David. Gotta go to Yerushalayim to go to fight the Shavim Michri. That made him late. That was the reason he was late. So the Gemara tells us that Avner and Amasa were told directly by the king, verbally told, to do something that went against the Torah, and they didn't listen. They didn't listen. Whereas Yoav was given a letter that said to go against the Torah, that was the letter that said to have Uriah Hachiti killed, Bathsheba's husband killed in battle, to push him to the front so he would be killed, and he listened. He listened to David's command, which was not consistent with the Torah, whereas Avner and Amasa did not listen to the command of their respective kings when it went against the Torah. So the Gemara tells us that's why when Yoav actually is killed later in the time of Shlomo, that's why it says, this is the Haftorah. Do we have it in the Haftorah? I believe we do. It's in the beginning of Malachim, but it is not in the Haftorah for Vayechi. The Haftorah ends a little bit too early. So, thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. It ends a little bit too early. When he actually has him killed, so it says, I'm not going to find it fast enough. Anyway, what it says is that he killed, Yoav had killed Avner and Amasa, two men who were better than he was. Tovim Mimenu. So the Gemara says, in what way were they better than he was? They weren't greater warriors than he was. They weren't greater Talmidei Chachamim than he was. I mean, he was a huge. They were all great. Mm-hmm. In what way were they better? They were better because, in this regard, they didn't listen to a direct command when it went against the Torah, and he did listen to a direct command when it went against the Torah. In that way, they demonstrated they were better than he was in that regard. So, what we have then is, to sum up, is a very complicated situation over here in which Yoav does not hold Amasa's appointment against Amasa. again, we don't know whether he was upset or not upset, but it didn't play out over here. But at the same time, he interprets Amasa's tardiness as a rebellion. Now, did he know the reason for the tardiness? It's unclear. Either he knew and felt it was wrong for Amasa to have delayed, or he didn't know. Either way, he didn't investigate, and therefore he is held liable for killing Amasa, even though in his own mind he was doing it for a higher purpose, which was because he was rebellious. And in order to promote David, he kills Amasa. So
who kissed who?
Yoav leaned forward to kiss Amasa. But Amasa, they were embracing.
Okay.
Right. So now, this he is going to be taken to task for this death, and when the Gemara goes through the things that Avner did wrong, so the killing, not Avner, excuse me, Yoav did wrong. Remember, the killing of Avner, the Gemara says, is excusable because Avner had killed Yoav's brother Asael. And therefore, Yoav was acting as the Goel Adam, redeeming the blood or avenging the blood of his brother. But Amasa, the Gemara does not have an excuse for Yoav. So for this is going to be the main reason why David HaMelech on his deathbed will instruct Shlomo to make sure to kill Yoav. And remember, the reason why David is going to tell Shlomo to do that is to prevent Yoav from ending up in Gehenna. Now, why doesn't David kill Yoav now? And how could he just put him back as being the general? Because at the end of the day, Yoav is not a murderer. He does something wrong. I shouldn't say he's not a murderer. He's not a premeditated murderer for no reason. He believes he's acting according to the Torah in killing Amasa. So he may be wrong for not having investigated properly or for misinterpreting the law and not realizing that Amasa was correct, but he's not a cold-blooded murderer. So therefore, you're not going to put him to death as a murderer. But nevertheless, he definitely did something wrong. So David then is going to reinstate Yoav as the general because he is the most qualified person and he is doing a good job. He's not a bad general. We're going to see how it's going to play out with Sheva ben Bichri, and he's going to reinstate him. However, Yoav nevertheless does do something wrong for which he has to atone, and David doesn't want him to get punished after death, and he's going to have Shlomo kill him while he's still alive. To kill him before he dies naturally. He doesn't die a natural death in order that he should achieve atonement. Yeah.
The generals I've known, like, they can do whatever to the people under their command, short of something like murdering them.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, they have a lot of control.
Yeah.
But before they could say that, you know, whatever, they have to go through court for the person to be court-martialed or whatever, you know, to be punished. Why here does Yoav have such power that he can decide on his own without consulting with anyone?
Okay, that's a good question. I mean, the Gemara says, I can't remember if it says that about Amasa or about Avner, where they said to him, why didn't you bring him to court? And over there, the Goel Hadam does not bring to court. The Goel Hadam kills him on the spot. I don't remember if the Gemara says that about Amasa. It's a fair question. I don't know the answer.
You did discuss that back when we talked about Avner.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't so clear that he was a Goel Adam.
Yeah.
I had a question about this verb back in Lehazik, you know, where David tells Amasa to go get the men of Yehuda. So I was wondering, that's an unusual.
It's not so unusual.
Does that imply, what exactly does that mean?
It literally means,
to grab? Is it like the word to grab?
No, it's more like the word to cry out, like tzak.
Like to rally then?
Yes.
By shouting
yes.
out?
Yes, okay. Yeah.
All right, because I was wondering if there was a hint there to what was to follow, since it wasn't just a simple, you know, go out and round them up.
Right.
That maybe it... Maybe there's some implication or some hint in there that I mean, knowing now what you just said, maybe the implication is that he would have to cry out in order to rouse them from their learning.
Okay, it could be, but the term is, seems to be used in gathering an army with Amalek, Shaul and Amalek. Vayizaek Shaul v'chol ha'am asherito.
Okay.
Actually, that one isn't even with Amalek. Later on, it says it again with Amalek. Says that that's one place it says it, and it says it later on again.
Can I just ask? I'm puzzled where it said that his sword fell out.
Yes, yes.
But it doesn't tell us that he picked up the sword.
That's true.
And usually it tells
you all the details. That's a good question. I wondered that. I mean, it says it was in his hand, so the implication is he must have picked it up. But
yeah,
right. But why doesn't it?
I think when it starts falling out, you feel it and you would grab it.
Well, it says it fell though.
So you mean you're saying maybe he caught it before it actually hit the ground?
Right. We don't. It never says it hit the ground.
It just fell.
It might have been that it starts falling out.
Usually it tells us little details.
Right. Yeah,
you're just asking. You usually get more details.
Even if he's wearing it oddly, so it will fall out. So he lets it fall out so he can pick it up.
Right. That's true.
Have it in his hand.
So Dina's asking, like, so okay, so then tell us all that he picked it up, and he's right. It's a good point.
Did he have a conversation with Amasa and ask him why he was late?
I don't know.
Or did he just go straight and kill? I mean, if he didn't even ask for the excuse, which was a good excuse.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. I don't know if Yoav didn't investigate, and that's what he's being taken to the task for, or if he did and disagreed with the reason.
So he must have asked him?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
He asked, is it well with you, my brother?
Yeah, but
that's the first thing he's saying.
Yeah, but it doesn't necessarily... Yeah, Jimmy, it sounds like it's a greeting.
It's a greeting.
It does sound like it's a greeting.
Why are you late?
Yeah.
I told you to be back yesterday.
I would think another reason for his carrying this out might be that he knew that Amasa was not as great a general as he himself was, and he did not want to risk this rebellion not being put down. Now, maybe that's not a...
The Gemara says the reason. See, if the Gemara doesn't say the reason, then it's up to us
so
to...
So we know the reason.
Yeah, okay. The Gemara says it. So.
All right, I have one last...
It's also interesting that they're called Yoav's men when they're following Amasa, but then when they see Amasa dead...
Well, they're called Yoav's men when they're following his brother, Avishai. Then they're called Yoav's men.
Okay, not Amasa.
Because Amasa's not there. He isn't there, so...
They meet up with him on the way.
I mean, if I just saw somebody who said we're going to war and they just killed somebody, I would be frightened and I would
follow
them up even more.
Okay.
Not less, if you're men of war, right?
Nice.
You would think that.
So all this detail about Amasa bleeding his guts out and having to be rolled aside, that's a whole lot.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that. Perhaps we will. Yeah, I would have to look into that a little bit. I wondered about
so
it.
So what I wondered about it, you don't have to take time on this now, but I just wondered, since they keep calling him Amasa and not the body or the corpse or whatever, was he still alive throughout all of this?
Yeah, interesting.
And it was like an insult to him.
Yeah,
too.
I don't know. That's a good question.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.